This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. As thousands commemorate the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr., Cincinnati City Council votes to conduct a study to determine if city programs and policies are racist.
There are none of us in this city who believes for a moment that the playing field is level. Whether we're talking about sex, whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about sexual orientation or whatever the case may be.
Councilmember Wendell Young. Later on the show,
where can we remove entire sections of government where the government is not the most effective and efficient entity for delivering a particular service to the people?
Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin proposes a state budget that eliminates 70 programs in order to fund pension reform. And General Electric's new CEO says GE may split into separate companies. How might that affect the Cincinnati area? Joining us to discuss these and other stories are, from the Cincinnati Inquirer, City Hall reporter Cameron Knight, and Race and Communities reporter Mark Kernute, and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Mark, good to see you this afternoon. Cameron, thank you for being here, and Bill, good to see you as well.
Happy to
come in.
So, Bill, start us off here. The city is going to study its policies and its programs to look for racism and disparity. What led up to this?
Well, in 2014, the city commissioned a Crozon study, which looked at how the city was handing out business contracts to minority-owned businesses, woman-owned businesses. And this is going to be kind of like that, except it's going to be policies and procedures and practices that the city does to see, to make sure that there is no disparity, that people of all ethnicities, all colors, all creeds are all treated fairly.
Cameron, what exactly will they be looking for in this?
Well, that's the interesting part, is that they haven't really defined it yet. The person who's kind of leading the charge on this, or at least this week, was P.G. Sittenfeld. And he mentioned a couple things. He said that the fire department is seeing a drop, that he called it a generational low, of African-American firefighters on the force. So he said that would be like one example of something that they would look into. He also has championed this private prisons initiative to pull the city's pension from investing in private prisons. He kind of touted that as another example of something that could be looked into as part of the study to determine what kind of disparities exist.
Do we have any idea how they're going to determine what areas to look into?
My understanding is that it's going to be handled through one of the committees of a city council, and the chair of that committee is Tamaya Denard, the new councilwoman, and that they're going to be determining kind of the costs and how to pay for it, how to commission it, and they're going to be developing basically a document that spells out what they want whoever does this study to do, and that's going to give a lot more specific goals about what the study wants to complete, because they're going to have to get someone to – they're going to have to pay someone to come in and conduct this study, and whoever's going to be bidding on that contract is going to need to know what they're expected to do. So once they have developed that RFP, as it's called, they'll have a lot better idea of what they want to look into.
So they'll have somebody externally – then take a look at all these things rather than doing this internally.
Correct. That's my understanding, is that they'll hire a company or a university or somebody that does this kind of work to come in, complete the objectives that they kind of spell out, and then they'll go and try to get some recommendations and move forward with changes.
Bill, Cameron was talking about the price of the study. Do they have even a rough idea of how much this might cost?
The Crozon study cost about $1 million. P.G. Sittenfeld, he estimates this is going to be in the six-figure range.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And how many other cities, Cameron, have done something similar to this?
PG, during the press conference this week, said that we weren't the first, that there were some other studies. He mentioned Seattle had done some other kind of disparity studies like this. It's a little hard to compare apples to apples because we don't exactly know what they're looking into. The Crozon study was specifically targeting contracts. So, you know, do construction work for the roads, who's going to do specific things. So it was a very targeted study. This study is a lot more open-ended right now because they just haven't defined those objectives yet.
Right. We use the term they're looking for racism, but they're really looking for signs of disparity and inequality, right, in the city's programs
exactly.
And policies.
They're just trying to see to make sure that Tamaya Denard kind of put it a certain way. She said, in some of the policies in the city, and she didn't name anything specifically, but she said some of the policies in the city, they pick winners and losers, and that's what they're really trying to get away from. They're trying to make sure that the processes for city money, for taxpayer money to be spent, are done in a way that it isn't based on who's friends with who or you know, anything like that. They're trying to just make sure that it's a fair and open process across the board, and that's black, white, racism, sexism, ageism, anything like that.
So. Yeah, Mark, what are your perspectives on this study?
I haven't had a lot of time to work on it. I've been working on some other things, but a couple of conversations I had that followed up King Day after this was announced the other day, there's people that think it's a good thing, people of color who think it's a good thing, and then there's others that say that for a lot less than $500,000, they can tell the city exactly what's wrong with city government in terms of racism and sexism. So, you know, there's a sense that there's enough data out there that already shows disparities. But, again, picking up on the Crossan study, if this is something that can show inequality within city government or within the mechanisms of city government, there could be some positive effects from it.
And the other interesting thing is that they brought up over and over again this 2015 study out of the Urban League that was called Two Cities, and it was a look at how African American Cincinnati and Caucasian Cincinnati are so segregated and separated. And I know that Mark has done a lot of work on a lot of work with that. So, but they're just, they mentioned a lot about the, just the segregation and the disparities and the fact that, we try to be this one whole networks that are very separated.
Cameron, how tough might this be, setting up the criteria and identifying what's racist, what creates disparity?
Well, I mean, it's going to be tough to decide exactly what to focus on, because that's going to be the hardest thing, is deciding what exactly they want to target. You know, do they want to look at hiring practices or recruiting practices for the fire department? That is a very, very different thing than looking at our pension system, for example. The two examples PG used, fire department and pension system, those are two very different systems. I would assume it would be pretty challenging, but depending on how much they have to spend, I'm sure it's a study. They're not trying to, this is just trying to identify problems, not necessarily fix them. So I would imagine that, trying to get something studied or looked at, you just have to get the right people to do it.
Has council officially voted on this yet, or is this just a proposal at this point?
Right now, it's just a motion, and there are seven council members who have signed it. The two that haven't are Christopher Smitherman and Amy Murray. I talked to Smitherman this morning, and he says he had never heard about it until he found out about it in the news. The proposal was never brought by him. PG Sittenfeld, no one else who did sign, contacted him, asked him to sign. Of course, he spent the weekend with his wife, who is in the hospital and is ill, and he is not all that happy about having his name put on there with a blank line, making it look like that he's chosen not to sign it. He says he's still considering whether he will or not. He told me he did propose something not dissimilar to this during the previous administration, but it didn't go anywhere. P.G. Sittenfeld himself says he expects all nine will sign it when it's said and done, and he expects to get the support of the mayor.
So Vice Mayor Smitherman's point right now, though, is he's just not happy with the process.
Correct.
That they've used for bringing this forward, if I'm understanding correctly.
Correct. I've not been able to talk to Amy Murray to see what she's thinking of it.
So what kind of time frame are we looking at? I mean, it hasn't been passed yet, so obviously it has to come up. It has to be passed before it can move forward. Is that right, Cameron?
Yeah, it'll have to get out of committee, and then it'll go before the full council. Even at that point, again, there's still going to be a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of getting that RFP, RFQ, those two kind of things that need to happen before the bidding can even start. So there's going to be a lot of work done in committee and things to get all the processes together in place before there's a bid. Then the study will have to get done, and then there'll have to be recommendations and different things like that. So it'll be – I'm assuming it'll take quite a while before we get any kind of tangible results out of this effort.
And we've been comparing this to the Croson study. How long did that take to put together and pull off any
– I think they finally got that back in 2016. I think they started the process in 2014. And if memory serves, they got the results back in 2016.
So this could take
a couple of years.
Yeah, so this could take years to put together as
sure,
well.
Sure, sure.
Mark, you were covering the Martin Luther King Day celebrations in Cincinnati. You were at the march. I'm wondering if you can tell us about what the march was like, what the mood was on Martin Luther King Day.
You know, it's always a day of hope and of affirmation and of celebration. But clearly the past 2 years, there has been an undercurrent of concern. And it was especially there this year with a number of people I spoke with that, you know, many people point specifically to the reduction in the pieces of the Voting Rights Act, that the 2016 election was the first that was held in, you know, two generations without the full protection of the Voting Rights Act. There's concerns of you know, on the heels of the alleged comments by the president about immigration in the context of immigration policy, about Haiti and African nations and El Salvador, the terms he allegedly used about those countries. And there's people of color, African Americans, and those who are allied with them, and some of the immigrant communities that really feel that not just civil rights, but basic civil liberties are being threatened and eliminated. And there's just a sense of concern and of an idea that things need to be – people need to be recommitted to protecting those hard-won advances of the 1960s and 70s that were, you know, forced through the civil rights movement.
So were you hearing a message of, yes, we've made progress, but we've got a long way to go? Is that what you were hearing?
Over and over again. Many times people say, yeah, we've made – it wasn't just, again, that we still have a ways to go. It's that we need to protect and hold the ground because we're losing ground, and there's a potential to lose more ground.
And when you talk about losing grounds, it's things like what you were saying earlier. It's the Voting Rights Act.
Correct. And then just, you know, related to that is immigration policy, social safety net, other programs that, you know – communities of poverty and not just communities of color, but communities of poverty have suffered. And this, with this being the 50th anniversary in April of Dr. King's assassination, you know, there was a reemergence of some conversation about the Poor People's Campaign, and that, you know, lower income white communities, lower income communities of color have a great deal in common. But yet there seems to be that racial division in spite of that potential common ground and shared concern.
What was the question that was raised at the MLK celebration this year?
Oh, goodness, what was that? I had it in the story. You're catching me. It's like I'm failing the test. I think it was, if not now, when, okay. If not.
Yeah, that's it.
And I think the other piece was, if not me, who?
Okay. So kind of explain what they're asking there.
You know, I think those go back to the civil rights movement, and that really we all have the sense people were saying is that we all have a personal responsibility, you know, not just to ourselves, but to, you know, the people in the community, our larger community, who are vulnerable, who could be negatively affected by policy coming out of Washington. A couple people even mentioned that the changes in the tax laws that were voted on and approved by Congress and signed by the president at the end of December, that changed tax law and possibly could be raising the taxes. I'm not a tax attorney, obviously, but you know, people were saying, you know, my taxes are going to go up and I hardly make anything right now. So a lot of those national issues have been absorbed locally by people.
And Bill, you covered the MLK celebration in Westchester. What was the mood and the atmosphere like there?
It was cold, I'll tell you that much. It was snowing when I got up there, and there were about 100 people who marched over to Lakota West for a presentation. So you really can't judge the event on its size given the weather. But a number of people I've heard have said, Westchester has a Martin Luther King Day celebration? Well, yeah, they do. They have a march and then music and speeches and all of that. Now, Westchester, according to 2016 census estimates, is 78% white and 9% African American. And talking to people about this, they were very proud that their community has this event. It would be, you know, easy just to say, oh, if you want to celebrate the day, go down to Cincinnati, because that's where the big one is. That's the big celebration. But people were very proud of the community for having this. You know, I talked to one woman who says, it means people in Westchester, in Butler County, are willing to listen, they're willing to talk to each other, and they want a community that that really does represent who lives there.
Now, Mark, you've been following the case of, I believe it's Giancarlo Mendez. Mm-hmm. Okay, now he's a caregiver for a six-year-old paraplegic boy. And he's facing deportation for overstaying his period of admission in the visa waiver program. He had been living in Springdale. Now he's being held in federal custody in Morrow County, which is north of Columbus. What's the most recent status on his case?
Well, yesterday, his attorneys last week had filed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals here in Cincinnati and had received a temporary stay of deportation so that the Sixth Circuit could, consider whether it had jurisdiction and whether the case had merits to be heard. And so they did grant the stay late Friday, and yesterday filed papers, the Sixth Circuit did, that it evidently will be hearing this case, and it set up a schedule for briefs to be filed both by Mr. Mendez's attorney as well by the government. And that timeline stretches to late March, early April. So in the meantime, he is in custody in Morrow County, which, like Butler County, has a contract with Immigration and Customs Enforcement as a holding facility. The story we had, that the reason I was rushing in here late, and it should be on our website right now, is that yesterday the sheriff of Morrow County was not going to allow Mr. Mendez and his fiancée to be married, and he has reconsidered and said if ICE approves that, he will allow their marriage to happen in the jail in Morrow County.
Now, can the courts ultimately stop his deportation?
According to case law that I looked at and conversation with a retired federal judge, Nathaniel Jones, who was a member of the Sixth Circuit for about 23, 24 years, they do have authority to overrule a deportation order from ICE, from that agency. And again, they clearly saw the merits of the case based on the hardship application that was filed by his attorneys. Given that Mr. Mendez does care directly, for the young boy, for Ricky, who is paraplegic and is hospitalized right now with several other complications, a great deal of internal bleeding that is going to require more surgery. So if they are able to be married, it does give Mr. Mendez at least one piece of a legal relationship. He is not the birth father. He is not the adoptive father. But this would make him legally the stepfather of the child. And in a case like this, immigration law states that if there is the marriage, anyone under 18 does legally become the stepchild of the other spouse.
And before we wrap up the segment, Cameron, you had an interesting piece after Hawaii went through its scare where the false alarm went out onto people's cell phones about an incoming missile. You wrote about how with tensions rising between North Korea and the U.S. About possible nuclear war, it's more real than it's been in decades. And you asked the question, could this kind of thing happen here in Cincinnati?
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek story, but basically we wanted to ask are these same warning systems that were used in Hawaii, are those active in Ohio, which they are. So technically speaking, any of us could get a alert at any time that says a missile's coming. We have that technology to alert people. I also wanted to ask, you know, what kind of systems were in place to guard against a false alarm. The Ohio EMA, Emergency Management Agency, was pretty clear that they have a lot of protocols in place that would prevent a false alarm like that from going out. Obviously, without actually like looking over the shoulder of how it's all done, it was a little hard. We kind of have to take their word on that. And then I also just kind of wanted to look at the past about what it was like here during the big nuclear scares of the 60s.
Cincinnati had somewhat of an obsession at the time, didn't it?
Oh, I mean, the whole country had an obsession.
And it's understandable.
Yeah. I mean, people were very, very scared. There was a whole boom industry that came up in the very early 60s of fallout shelters. There were communities all over the country that were trying to build community ones. We had Cincinnati had a community fallout shelter that was utilized the old abandoned subway system up on Liberty Street. And I just kind of looked into that. And then I managed to find a woman who bought a house in Clifton in the 70s that had a fallout shelter in the basement.
So some of these signs still exist?
And it still exists. Yeah, the fallout
shelter. Sign and the fallout shelter.
Yeah, yeah. And so it was just kind of a look at our past and kind of looking forward, what's the, you know, what if something terrible were to happen, would we be able to be alerted? What's the way that it would look? How would it look today? And it seems like it would look like we would get little messages on our cell phone that say, you know, take cover.
Yeah, and I guess that's the key piece of advice. Take cover, take shelter is what officials will tell you in an instance
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what they say. They say that it's just shelter in place and find a place underground if you can. And, you know, I mean, depending on where a missile's coming from and all this kind of stuff, there would be a predictable window of time, I think, that we would have a certain amount of time to get, you know, get to a place where you'd be safe. And but the other thing that is that I found really interesting is that anyone who studies this would say, you know, if it lands on your house, there's nothing you're going to be able to do. But and so there's this distance scenario too, where you have to say, you know, if you're 3 or 4 miles away, yeah, maybe you'll be okay. If you're 10 miles away, if you're half a mile away, it could be a lot worse. So it's a lot of speculation in terms of what would actually happen, but it's kind of an interesting thought exercise to go through and say, what would it look like if something happened around here?
I guess the key thing is you're more likely to be hurt or die in a car accident in this area than...
Way more likely to be hurt or killed in a car accident.
Cameron, thank you. And Mark, thank you. And Bill, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
From the Cincinnati Inquirer, City Hall reporter Cameron Knight and Race and Communities reporter Mark Carnute and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. Coming up, Governor Matt Bevin releases his budget proposal for Kentucky. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin is promising to fully fund the state's pension systems, but it's going to take a lot of budget cuts to do it. And joining me to analyze Bevin's budget proposal is Tom Loftus, who covers the Kentucky State House for the Louisville Courier-Journal. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tom, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So Governor Bevin is putting out this budget proposal, and he is talking about eliminating, 70 different programs in the state?
That's right. That's probably the lead on this story, that his budget proposes to eliminate funding for 70 different programs scattered throughout the bureaucracy in state government. Things largely not big programs, but a few were kind of big, and most of them very popular programs that he says if he didn't eliminate them, the cuts across the board to other parts of government, which were about 6% cuts, would have had to have been a lot deeper. So he said he scoured through the budget and said we've got to focus on the things we need to do rather than the things we want to do. So we eliminated 70 programs.
Hey, can you give me an example, Tom, of some of the programs that are being eliminated?
There are all kinds of programs, Mark. There are health programs, a colon cancer screening program, a breast and cervical cancer screening program, lung cancer research, all sorts of different types of smaller scholarship funds, various specific programs at various universities would be eliminated if this is accepted, including the Kentucky Center for Mathematics at Northern Kentucky University up there. But Department of Education, the main school funding program, public school funding program, was not cut by the governor. That's the biggest appropriation in the entire budget. He was quite glad that he was able to avoid a cut in that program, but a lot of support programs for public schools, textbooks, professional development for teachers were not funded, were on the list of 70 programs that were axed. And key is that student transportation funds to local districts were cut. And I mean, from the school district perspective, it's great that the base school funding program was not, but they still have to pick up the students. So they were all across the board. I mean, the Commission on Women, a small agency that advocates for various women's causes, been around since the 70s, was not funded. Conservation districts, local aid, state tree nurseries, handful of smaller environmental programs like that. So there were a bunch of them.
Last fall, Tom, Governor Bevin asked government agencies to come up with cuts. Did they do that? Did they, or any of these things they suggested?
Well, it was really, really interesting. He asked for cuts, but really never followed through with that round of cutting. Later in the year, they cut a smaller amount, and these cuts he's proposing in this budget fall on top of a small cut the governor implemented to current year funding at the end of 2017. And it's worth noting that these cuts are just the latest in really more than a decade of budget cuts in Kentucky. The all states in the 2008-2009 pit of the national recession had to cut as revenues fell. Kentucky's revenues have recovered, as have most states. All states, really, as we've pulled out of the national recession. But Kentucky's problem, and this is the reason for the cuts, is its huge unfunded liability within its pension programs for teachers, state and local government employees. That unfunded liability has grown. It was not taken care of during the worst of the recession.
How big has that unfunded liability become, Tom?
Officially, it's booked at $43.8 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars right now. Governor Bevin says that's using various assumptions that are a little bit optimistic. He says it's north of $60 billion. Well, this budget fully funds pensions, puts a lot of money into pensions, and presumably will get that on track. He basically says that we need to focus on, again, the things we need, not the things we want. And if we pass this budget, our financial house is in order. And he also emphasized that he wants to do tax reform either later in this session or in a special session later this year to help allow Kentucky to raise more money as the economy improves and as Kentucky's economic development projects that have been announced over the past year.
But tax reform is not in this budget proposal itself.
It is not in this budget proposal. Frankly, it would be a miracle if they passed tax reform in this session.
I was going to ask, have they unveiled a bill of any type? Because I keep hearing it's coming.
That's an excellent question. The answer is no. The governor's generally talked about ideas he has for tax reform. Both he and everybody else want to eliminate a lot of the tax exemptions, credits, special tax treatments, closing loopholes, which could raise potentially a significant amount of money. But which loophole and which exemption gets closed? These are really tough questions. Taxes is by far the most difficult issue for the Kentucky General Assembly to try to tackle, which is why it's so seldom done. And I think it could well be done later this year at a special session. I doubt very much if it's done during the current regular session.
Tom, Governor Bevin's laid out his ideas, his proposal for Kentucky's budget. And the key thing is, at this point, it's just a proposal. So what's next in this whole process?
Well, it goes to the House Budget Committee, which will spend the next few weeks talking it over. And it's not going to be a lot of fun. It's the first time in my experience, and really probably the first time in 100 years, that committee's been controlled by Republicans here. They will look it over and will have very difficult time balancing out. They'll make some changes. I don't know where they'll come up with the money if they want to fill some of the gaps left by Governor Bevin, because it's going to be hard to do. But when they finish it, probably in mid-February, they'll dish it to the House floor, which will vote it and pass it. Goes through the same process in the Senate, and I don't think it'll be any different. Than it's been in years past. It'll be the very last days of the session, which would be in early April, when the House and Senate reconcile their differences on the budget bill, and presumably they'll pass a budget which will a very lean budget, which will carry us through the next 2 years.
But I guess the key things are to remember the 70 programs that are being eliminated. Then it's, 6% across the board cuts?
6.25%. It should be noted. I mean, the governor spoke when he spoke. The things he emphasized were few things where he did find a little bit more money. He found about $34 million more for fighting the opioid epidemic, $24 million more for social workers, about $11 million more for adoption and foster care supports, and a little bit more money to hire some more prosecutors as well as public defenders. Those are sort of some of our more urgent needs here in Kentucky in this budget. He didn't do much, but he should be credited for finding a little bit more money for some of these areas in particular need.
Tom, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
I'm happy to join you.
Tom Loftus, who covers the Kentucky State House for the Louisville Courier-Journal. Up next, what might the potential GE split mean for Cincinnati? And after the Amazon loss, Cincinnati turns its sights on Apple. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. GE CEO says the company may split into separate companies, with GE Aviation located in Evendale and its global ops headquarters in downtown Cincinnati. A lot of people are wondering what this might mean for the Cincinnati area. And joining me to discuss this and other business news of the week are Alex Coolidge from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Alex, good to see you this afternoon.
Hey there.
And Dan Monk from WCPO.com. Dan, thank you for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Alex, what do we know exactly what GE CEO is talking about? I mean, how many parts is he talking about splitting the company into? Is it three parts? Would aviation become its own business? How's that going to work?
Well, what he actually said was very deliberately, he teased the subject without too many details.
He was purposefully vague?
Oh, yes. Because GE's going through just such turmoil right now. I mean, he needs all options on the table, but he was announcing a warning that his earnings were going to be very underwhelming. We'll say that nicely. They were going to take this massive charge in relation to their financial business. GE has gone of embraced becoming more of a pure play industrial, but it still has financial operations. They're about the size of Fifth Third still embedded in the company. They're chopping that up and selling it off. But anyway, they had some huge insurance reserve that they had to do with $6 billion in the fourth quarter. Yeah. And it's like, I got to throw – well – Basically, the CEO made a point of saying something else, meant to be a little encouraging, I guess, to shareholders, saying, "Oh, but don't worry, you know, we have other things in the works that'll sort of make this." And basically, the long and short was, he said, "You know, we're looking at the company, and we've decided that." You know, we've got some wonderful assets here, but they're being, I think the word was suppressed. And that was CEO speak for basically saying, we've got some amazing assets, but they're connected with these other things in our company that are holding down the value of them. And then he talked about splitting something apart, and he was clearly discussing the company going forward as potentially multiple companies in the future.
Dan, might some of this be Nelson Peltz's influence? I mean, he just got a seat on the board of GE, and some of this sounds like things he suggested for Procter & Gamble when he was getting a seat on their board.
Yeah, it's definitely the MO that P&G thought they should expect from Peltz, you know. And that's what they were telling shareholders, you know, last summer. But, you know, the thing about the GE situation is that they have so many entanglements from their financial subsidiary that nobody really knows if it's even going to be possible to break apart this company. They have like $120 billion in debt. They have a pension that's about $30 billion unfunded. Are underfunded, and so in order to break apart the company, they're going to have to come to some kind of an accommodation with their lenders, and they're going to have to take apart the liabilities as well as the assets. So, you know, GE Aviation would be a great company if it was standalone and operating, you know, with this huge backlog of engine orders. But if you attach billions of dollars of liability to it, it's suddenly not so great a company. So there's real debate going on Wall Street now and among analysts as to whether that would even cause the stock price to go up at GE, whether the sum of the parts is actually worth more than GE is worth today.
So is it, Alex, is it fair to say, though, that GE Aviation and Avondale, they're on fairly solid ground?
They are the most profitable unit of the entire company, and they are one of the strongest growers. If GE Aviation was carved out as its own company, it would be a Fortune 500 company in its own right.
What about
and a very profitable one.
What about Global Ops sitting on the banks? I
mean, what? That is a different situation. Basically, that was set up as one of, I think it's four such operations around the world, but it was meant as basically, it was meant to basically consolidate back office functions.
Right, they're a support group. Yeah.
Yeah, but for the whole company. But if you obliterate the entire whole company structure, by the way, I found the actual quote by the CEO. I can read it to you in a sec. But basically, if you obliterate... If you break apart the company, then you got to ask, well, what are we going to do with these back office functions that were set up for the whole company, you know, if we've got three or four companies. Obviously, if you go down that route, there's obviously a transition. You know, you don't snap your fingers and have it happen overnight or anything like that. But hiring there has already stalled. They were originally going to have, what, about 1,800 jobs there. They halted it at about 1,400 last May. It's now, they're now saying, hey, it now employs more than 1,300. So it suggests there's been a little runoff already in the months before. I found the quote here by Flannery.
Are we sure we want to hear this?
Yeah, you might. Yeah, you know, it sounds. I am quote. I am more convinced than ever that we have substantial underlying strengths and value that have been suppressed in the current context. As a result, we are looking aggressively at the best structure or structures for our portfolio to maximize the potential of our businesses. That's CEO speak for we've got assets that are holding other assets back in terms of realizing their full value and potential, and shareholders, please don't panic. We're working on something that will make you whole. Meanwhile, the company's stock this week has been
down around $16 now, which is down quite a bit.
It's a new multi-year low, the worst since 2011, and not like 2011 was a banner year for GE. I mean, they haven't had a good year since.
But based on what I'm hearing here, Dan, there's nothing definite. There's no definite plan out there yet,
just a
general idea
of
where he'd like to take this.
They have to do something with the stock price. I think it's at the lowest level since the 2008 recession. That's where their stock price is. So they are going to have to do some kind of, you know, financial engineering, I guess, to try to juice the stock price. But I think most of the stories I've read and the analyst commentary I've seen is that people are not very optimistic that they're going to be able to turn it around very soon. I don't think people think they know exactly what kind of liabilities are still included in the financial subsidiaries that, I mean, they've sold them off, but they retain some liabilities. And I don't even know if they know if GE has hit bottom yet. So
now, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Dan, I wanted to ask you about this. Cincinnati is no longer on the list of potential sites for Amazon's second headquarters. So what's been the reaction from local officials that you're hearing to that particular announcement?
I think the big takeaway from the business community is that they want to do something about transportation. They seem convinced that that was a big reason that that Amazon did not put us in the top 20. Although I've talked to other experts who've said it's basically the size of our economy and our lack of population growth that's caused it. You know, if you compare Indianapolis, Columbus, Pittsburgh,
who remain on the list.
Yeah, those three cities made it, and Cincinnati did not. What's different about those cities? They're all basically the same size in terms of the size of the labor market, all between 1 million and 1.2 million jobs. And what's different is that Columbus is growing about three times faster than Cincinnati in terms of population growth. Indianapolis is growing at about 6% compared to our 2.2%. And Pittsburgh is shrinking, but they have Carnegie Mellon, which is one of the world's biggest talent magnets for technology talent. So,
plus, if Amazon comes here, they become one name among Kroger's, Macy's, Procter & Gamble, GE. So they kind of come into a town where we have a big corporate presence already.
Yeah.
Where if you go to a place like Columbus, you know, it's a different matter.
Another factor is that Amazon has already committed $1.5 billion to the cargo hub that they're building at CVG Airport. So it's possible that they just scratch Cincinnati off the list because they've already made a big investment here and they don't want to put all their eggs in one basket.
And they could have the downtown Macy's, though.
Yeah, no. That's true.
Now I understand, and you wrote about this, Dan, that the talk is turning to Apple. If not Amazon, then perhaps Apple.
Well, it is kind of ironic that Apple announced, like the day before Amazon cut its list down, Apple announced that they were going to spend $30 billion and hire 20,000 people over and above their previous, you know, hiring objectives. And they said they're going to establish a new campus. They're now in California, Texas. They're building $1.5 billion investment in Reno, Nevada. And supposedly they're looking for another campus. And they told ABC News that that they have a handful of sites in mind, and they don't want a big auction type process like Amazon has done. So whether or not Cincinnati even has a chance to get into that game, you know, nobody really knows. But as we got scratched off the Amazon list, a lot of the, like the mayor, for example, was saying it's time to go after Apple. So, well, you know, we'll have to see how that plays out. But it's not really clear, A, how big that campus is going to be, and B, whether they'd entertain an offer from Cincinnati.
And well, how realistic is this opportunity for Cincinnati? I mean, do people seem to think we have a chance at this?
It sounds like it would be a smaller operation than a 50,000 job Amazon second headquarters. So, you know, I mean, the biggest problem I think for Cincinnati is that we're just not big enough to fill 50,000 jobs in 10 or 15 years.
One out of 20 of our labor force.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty tall order for a city our size that's growing at the rate we're growing.
And also, that headquarters for Amazon would have been 8 times the size of the Kenwood Center. I mean, that's a huge campus you're talking about.
Could the infrastructure transportation issue come back and bite us again on that?
It could, but I think Ready Cincinnati and the Chamber were pretty smart to make that their takeaway, because this is something they've been convinced we need in Cincinnati: better transportation and better ability to get workers to jobs using public transit. And so if the end result of this Amazon, you know, I guess you'd call it a snub or a failure, is to energize us and improving our transportation system, it will have been worth the bid.
Dan, thank you, and Alex, thank you as well. Cincinnati Inquirer business reporter Alex Coolidge and WCPO.com business reporter Dan Monk.